So I want to talk a little bit about a conversation I had with a student. She gave me permission to talk about her. I'm not going to use her by name. I'm going to call her Dahlia, because when I was working on this talk, I was sitting out looking at a Dahlia. So I'm going to call her Dahlia. So Dahlia is somebody who has studied the Dharma diligently for many, many years. And she shows up every week for Dokusan. She shows up every week for study group. And she applies practice to her life ongoingly in a very, very challenging life situation. And recently she shared with me a list of Dharma insights that she had put together some years ago. A lovely list. I could do a whole Dharma talk on this list of Dharma insights. But her comment about it was, why am I not doing these things? I'm not getting anywhere. I know these things, but I don't do them. I don't apply them. She was very frustrated. And it was like the implication of, I'm an insufficient practitioner because somehow I haven't checked everything off my enlightenment list, or I don't do all the time all the things that I imagine that I should be doing. There's something wrong with my practice. Of course, that rang a little bell with me, because those of you who know me know that that's something Catherine, my root teacher, and I used to talk about, so much so that she called it Kathy's question. How can I still be so imperfect if I've been practicing for so many years? Maybe some of you have that question. I won't ask you to reveal it. Not everybody does. And I don't anymore. I don't worry about that anymore. But anyhow, so Dahlia was really worrying about that. Now, you could say that that was just, it's her personal frustration. It's some personality thing that she has, or that I had when I was complaining about that to my teacher. But actually, if you go back and you look at the old ancestor stories, there's actually something that's quite archetypal and classical about this exchange, this student-teacher exchange. And so what I'd like to do is share a few of the old-time versions of this exchange, and then talk about it a little bit more in terms of what the nature of this exchange is. So the first exchange I'd like to talk about was in the 6th century, and this was Bodhidharma, who I'm sure most of you know, but in case somebody doesn't, I will just briefly say that he was the person in our lineage, the lineage that I am in, and many of us are practice with, who brought Zen from India to China. And so he was practicing in China, at the Sha near the Shaolin Temple. And a young man, or not young at the time, a fellow called Huike came up to study with Bodhidharma. Now there's lots of parts to the story about Huike and Bodhidharma that I'm not going to tell. I'm going to fast forward to this particular exchange that they had. This is after he had been studying for a while with Bodhidharma at the near the Shaolin Temple in ancient China. And Huike said, "Oh, teacher, help me, please. My mind is not at peace. My mind is so restless. I beg you, master, would you please put it to rest?" And Bodhidharma said, "Well, bring me your mind and I will put it to rest." So, good student that he was, Huike went out and started looking for his mind. Where is it? Where is my mind? What is this mind? He wants me to bring him my mind. I better look for it. And he looked high and he looked low. And after a while, he came back to Bodhidharma and he said, I've searched everywhere and I can't find my mind." And Bodhidharma said, "There, you see, I have put your mind to rest." So I'll come back and talk about that soon in a little bit. But I want to go a little further in the story. Hoika had received transmission from Bodhidharma. He went on to become a great teacher himself. And he was practicing in China in a time in the 6th century when it was really, really volatile environment, and the Buddhists were being persecuted by the government. So there were the Northern Zhao dynasty. The emperor was convinced that Buddhism was getting too powerful. It was threatening his power. And so he attempted to abolish Buddhism from his kingdom. And Bodhidharma said, Hoika, you know, you better just take off for a while and go hide in the mountains, because this is just not a good environment for us right now. So Hoika did. He spent 10 years alone in the mountains, avoiding the governmental persecution. And while he was up there practicing, at some point, he was visited by a practitioner whose name was Seng Chan. Now, we don't know very much about Seng Chan, but there's two really important things that we know about Seng Chan. And one of the things about Seng Chan is that when he first came to practice with Hoika, who was up practicing alone in the mountains, when he joined Hoika, he was suffering from leprosy. And I just think it's really important to pause for a moment here. I want to make a little comment about this. You know, I think sometimes there's this idea, especially in the modern world, that Buddhism, or the way we understand Buddhism, is like this, maybe this elite practice for people who can afford expensive retreats, or who can take time off from their lives and go to the monastery. And, you know, that it helps us be mellow and calm and all those kinds of things. And maybe people with challenging lives might think, oh, it doesn't apply to me. It's too idealized. It's too theoretical. That's why I think it's so important for us to really understand and know the lives of these ancestors whose dedicated practice brought the teaching to us, because their lives were not easy. This was not an idealized fantasy elitist practice. You know, there was Hoika hiding from political persecution in the mountains, and here was Seng Chan, who was suffering from leprosy. And these were two of our ancestors. And there's many, 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 many more stories. Not that I'm wanting to say there's anything good or bad about practicing with difficulty, but I just feel like it's an important part of the story for us to recognize the circumstances that some of our ancestors were dealing with. Now, the other thing that's really, that we do know about Seng Chan is he was the person who wrote Trust in Mind. And many of us love, in Zen, we love that poem. It's the one that starts, "The great way is not difficult for those who hold no preferences. When longing and aversion are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised." So Seng Chan is the one who wrote that. So those are a couple things to know about Seng Chan. But the reason why I bring him up is because he came up, he wanted to practice with Hoika, and guess what he said? He said, "Oh, teacher, teacher, please help me. I really need your help. I am infected with leprosy, and I beg you, would you please cleanse me of my wrongdoing?" And Hoika said, "Bring me your wrongdoing and I will cleanse it for you." So Seng Chan went looking for his wrongdoing. He looked high and he looked low. And he came back to Hoika and he said, "When I look for my wrongdoing, I cannot find it." And Hoika says, "There, I have cleansed your wrongdoing. Now you must rely on Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha." So what do these encounters, I've described three now, and if I put in my own with Catherine, I would say four, but let's say three for now, encounters, what do they have in common? Well, one of the things they have in common is that the person in the student role is looking outside of themselves for the relief of their suffering. Hoika is asking Bodhidharma, would you please put my mind at ease? And Seng Chan, thinking that his physical condition is somehow caused by wrongdoing, is wishing that someone could cleanse him of his wrongdoing. And Dahlia keeps hoping that if she could just study that right thing, find that right teacher, listen to that right Dharma talk, or in her case, one of her favorite fantasies is go to the monastery, then she'd really be able to wake up. And so the ancestors in the teacher role, but who had themselves been in the student role at an earlier time, were encouraging their students to realize that there is no permanent fixed place or thing that where restlessness or wrongdoing dwell. It's actually the mind that rests is the mind that then gets to experience relief. And the mind that is pure is the mind that stops looking for something to cleanse itself. When we stop judging ourselves about the past and fantasizing about our idealized future, that's when we wake up. It's not outside. It's not something that's going to happen that's not happening right now. It's about dropping off the obscuration, dropping off the judgment, dropping off that spinning, restlessness. You know, in my case, I just always would look at what I wasn't doing. And one time Catherine said to me when I was doing my usual complaint and saying, God, I just, you know, I don't sit Zazen enough. I don't do this. I don't do that. And she said, that's not what it looks like from outside. She said, from outside, I see you showing up. I see you helping. You know, I had some idea of what it was supposed to be like. And that's what happened when Dahlia and I were talking with each other. You know, I recognized when she brought that question forward, I felt a little bit of that, you know, that tingle or that charge that we get when we realize, oh, this is a dharmic moment. Here we are. This is actually something that Zen students have struggled with since the very beginning. And here we are, you know, Buddhas and ancestors of old, whereas we in the future shall be Buddhas and ancestors. So when Dahlia said to me, well, why am I not doing these things? I said, you're doing it right now. And when she said, but I'm not getting anywhere, I said, stop looking at what you're not doing. Look at what is. And then I just looked at her, you know, in the little Zoom window. And I said, you know, I really, really, really appreciate this being that I see sitting before me, who I experience is giving so much of her heart to this deep yearning that she has to awaken. God, I appreciate you so much. I appreciate your effort. And she teared up. That wasn't what she was expecting to hear. Because that restless mind is always thinking, oh, I'm not good enough. I'm not doing it enough. It's got to be something else. And to actually relax that one, to actually relieve ourselves of that burden and breathe into, this is it. right now, this act of sitting here together, being present, struggling and striving, is the awakening, is the practice of the Buddhas and the ancestors. Stop thinking, I said to her. Just stop it. She said, I want to get to the root. I want to get to the root of it. I want to get to the source. I said, you know the root. You know the source. Tell me right now, 5 things that you do that access your direct experience of your feeling of present moment awareness, what you would call the root, what you would call the source. 5 things. She said, well, the other day when I walked alone on the beach, I said, there's one. Great. Give me another one. I said, what did you do? Well, I anchored myself, my breath in my hara as I walked. And every time a thought came up that took me out of the moment, I said, come back to the breath. Come back to the breath. I said, that's great. That's 2. Now give me 3 more. I could feel her restless mind wanted to go, but I said, come on, give me 3 more. When I breathe deeply and I look up and I look out. Okay, great. Give me another one. Give me 4. When I have heartfelt dialogue and when we're really steadying our minds and when we're focusing our minds like this, I said, beautiful. Now give me 1 more. When I connect with others who are on the path. When ancestor Dongshan was taking leave of his teacher Yunyan, and he said, how should I remember you? Yunyan said, just this is it. It's the same teaching over and over and over and over. And yet our compulsion, our thinking that it's somewhere else, that that relief is out there, that there's something wrong with us, that we need to be cleansed. That's the obstruction. It's how we think. So it doesn't mean that we shouldn't think and that we shouldn't study and learn, because obviously that's really, really, really important to do. You know, study our causes and conditions, study the great teaching stories. There's wonderful things to study and learn, but I think that it's very important to become aware of when our inquiry, when the mind itself becomes the obstacle. And how do you know when your mind itself becomes the obstacle? When you start noticing that you're setting up dualistic constructs. I'm here, you're there. This is good, that's bad. This is enlightened, this is imperfect. That's one clue. And when these dualistic constructs are blocking your own experience of the present moment, that's when it's time to stop thinking. Drop it, as they say. Drop off body and mind. So really, really noticing it's a precious, precious resource, this human mind that we have and this ability that we have for critical thinking and inquiry. And yet it can also be our biggest obstruction to getting to taste the truth of the Tathagata, to relaxing into the gift of the Buddha Dharma. When Huike said to Sengchan, I have cleansed you of your wrongdoing. Now you must rely on Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. Sengchan said, well, what does that mean? He asked. And Huike said, mind is Dharma. Mind is Buddha. They are not two. The treasure of community, Sangha, is the same. And Sangchan said, today for the first time, I know that the nature of wrongdoing is neither inside nor outside nor in between. And Hueka said, you are my treasure. From now on, I will call you jewel of the community. And this is the intimacy of Zen. You know, this way that we bring our questions and our suffering and our struggle to each other, our tenderness, and we open our hearts and our minds and we ask these questions, and then we open ourselves to let ourselves be changed by our encounters so that we can be more present and awake to walk the path and to help sentient beings in this world that so needs people on the path. So how sweet is it that many years later, Sangchan, after spending his 10 years alone in the mountains, got a call from a visitor, a 14-year-old fella called Daoshun, who wanted to study with him and said, Master, Master, are you getting it? Master, Master, please help me. Would you help me? Teach me about liberation. And Sangchan said, who is binding you? No one is binding me. Then why are you seeking liberation? You know, it's really it's another facet. It's another example of the very same question and response. No one is binding you. You are already free. And this is the radical proposition of the Buddha Dharma. You know, I think this is why people, ever since Buddha started teaching, from all walks of life are drawn to this teaching. Because it's not a teaching that says that you have to be a certain way. It's not for the rich. It's not for the privileged. It's not just for this one race or this one gender or this one type of people or this one caste of people. All beings have the capacity to awaken. All beings have Buddha nature. And this is part of what has been our heritage and continues to be our heritage. Now, it's true that sometimes we have circumstances that make it really, really difficult to practice. And it's certainly harder to practice with, I would imagine, with external oppression, like the government persecuting you because you're a Buddhist, or if you're in a category of person that is experiencing oppression, all the different isms that we have in our societies. It's harder, of course, but every person, all of us, have the opportunity to free our minds from our internal oppression. We may not be able to do anything about the pain that's coming from outside, but we have everything to do with liberating ourselves from our internal oppression, our internal restlessness, our internal limiting beliefs, our self-criticism, our self-judgment. That's up to us. And that is the radical proposition of liberation that Shakyamuni Buddha offered at that time and that's still being offered to us today. Dharma teacher Galen Ferguson, he's not in our lineage, he's in the Shambhala wing of things, the Trungpa line, really excellent teacher, I think. And in the book Dharma, Color and Culture, which is a book that is about the Four Noble Truths, he calls this this liberation, stopping the inner battle that undermines our confidence and well-being. And he goes on to say, the key point here is that we are not victims of our states of mind. We are agents in our own making, in the emancipation of our minds and hearts. He calls it decolonizing the mind. Those external or conceptual standards that we impose on ourselves. The mistaken idea that judging ourselves is the way to increase our wisdom, compassion, and insight. Decolonize your mind, he says. And he does not use this word lightly. And from his experience as a Black man, he points out how liberation must include freeing ourselves from this vicious internal cycle of judgment and painful negativity, which he points out is especially important for people of color and for others who suffer from the isms of society, racism, sexism, homophobia, which isn't an ism, but it is. Because, as he says, we've grown up in society saturated with ideas and values that invalidate our very existence. So this act of decolonizing the mind from those external negative projections is especially important if we're practicing in an environment that's like that, in a hostile environment. So I'm almost ready to stop talking a little bit and find out what your thoughts are about this. But I did want to just say that we've chanted the Trust in Mind on Tuesday evenings for years, and I would be there as the Doshi. And after chanting, we'd gather on the porch, and invariably, you know, somebody would chuckle and say, yeah, right, you know, the great way is not difficult for those who hold no preferences. And we'd laugh because, of course, we all have preferences. And yet, what would that be like? Can you even imagine for a moment, what would it be like to live in the present and not from our picking and choosing? Could we even try that for 5 minutes? For 10 minutes? For an hour? And see what that feels like? It seems impossible, and yet it is something that we do taste now and then. We do. And I think that's part of what can encourage us to continue with our practice. So, may you, by releasing the grip of this grasping mind, may you experience mental ease. And by taking refuge in the triple treasure, may you experience the purity of original mind. And by giving up trying to be the perfect fill in the blank, may you let yourself just open to this potent moment. No one is binding you. You are already free. So with the words of the ancestors maybe reverberating a little bit in our hearts and minds, I'm wondering what you might want to say or ask about this practice of attending to the role that the mental capacity plays in our experience of awakening in this way. Yeah, Shakti.
Well, I was struck by this because I am someone who has a heck of a lot of challenges living in this body of mine. And the practice of meditation, just at its most basic level, what I do is I scan the body. So I just, you know, one part of my body might be screaming at me, but I'm like, it's not your turn. We're on the ear. So it's all about the ear right now. The rest of you, just take a chill pill. And I go, and then it's like, okay, now it's about, you know, the shoulder. So I don't care what anybody else has to say. We're just with the shoulder right now, you know, and then we're at the place that has been screaming. I'm like, okay, it's your turn. So what are you screaming about? What really is going on? Oh, well, it's just this. Come on. It's just this. That's all it is. It's just this. So what's the problem? Okay. We've been it. We dove right in it and we didn't explode. Nothing happened. It was just it. So that and it's the most basic kind of doing the actual meditation is really helpful for my physical pain. And then if I'm having kind of my brain is like freaking out about something, it also helps with that because then it's like you're freaking out about something, but you're like, we're not doing that right now. We're not freaking out. We're doing a body scan or we're focusing on the breath. And so all that craziness in the head has to take a chill pill. And then by doing the practice, it's like during the day when I start going off onto those tangents, I'm like, oh, I have a tool for this. I go back to my breath or I focus on a different part of the body than the one that's hurting. I do something where I have these little tools that I've learned through meditation. So, you know, at its basic, and I like the idea too about liberation comes from not picking and choosing, because that's really, what I'm experiencing in a lot of ways is liberation from the tortures of living in my body. You know,
I so appreciate you sharing your practice, Shakti. I feel like your dharma is so beautiful and so strong and so encouraging for all of us, because you really do, I think, show how we can work with really, really, really challenging situations that you live in every moment of your life, you know, with it, with the pain in your body and how you practice with it and how dedicated you are to staying present and to developing these tools and these strategies for staying present. So thank you so much for sharing your experience with us.
Yeah. It's
invaluable.
So important to me. And the Sangha is, you know, it helps me so much. So when I meditate with others, it feels that much stronger. Yeah. So thank you.
Yeah. As Hweka said, when we take refuge in the triple treasure, we know the original purity of mind. Yes. Anybody else?
This is Kai. Hi.
Hi. Hi, Kai.
Thank you. I'm sorry you can't see me. Thank you so much for that Dharma talk. It was really inspiring, Kathy. I enjoyed it. And I like your passion when you deliver your talk and your hands are all over the place. But what I wanted to say, to tag on to what Shakti just said, someone at the center 25 years ago said this after a Dharma talk. I don't remember who it was. You might recall. But it has stuck with me all these years, and I often share it. And what they said was, this practice is impossible. I vow to do it. And that keeps me coming back to the cushion, because there are times where I stray and get into my preferences and my aversions. So I just wanted to share that and thank you all for being.
Sounds like Catherine, she maybe her paraphrase of the Bodhisattva vows.
Right.
Yeah. Because that is at the heart of our Bodhisattva vows, is that we're not waiting until everything's perfect before we start practicing. Mm-hmm. Because we don't expect things to get perfect. We know that we just do our best to actualize our vow and our practice as best we can. Thank you.
You're welcome. I want to share something else because you just triggered it. There was a guy who ran the gym on Seabright Avenue where I lived, and his name was Bob. And at the time, he was really, really old. He was like 65.
Man, ancient.
And I'm now 68, and I still think I'm young, and he's still old. But every morning I'd come in, I'd say, "Hi, Bob, how you doing?" And every morning he would say, "Perfect and getting better." And that's it.
Yeah. Thanks, Kai. I was going to say good to see you, but I don't see you. But I did see you once, so I have a picture of what you look like. You flashed in one time.
Did I?
It was, it was one of these times. You had, for a minute, I saw you.
Okay.
Your presence is very strong. So thanks for being here again.
Well, I really love that you guys are here. And I zoom into a lot of different places around the country. But this is the place I come back to every week. So you guys have a strong presence in my life as well.
What about this, the mind is, you know, this picking and choosing mind, this restless mind. How do you work with that in your daily life?
Are you talking to me?
I'm just asking the room. Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to wait for the room to answer.
Jean?
Well, it seems like there is one kind of picking and choosing that's cumbersome, I guess I would say. And there's a different kind of picking and choosing, like I've got two options or three options in front of me, and they're all fine. I'll just pick one, because if I stand at that crossroads, I'm basically paralyzed and passive until I pick one. So that's a different kind of picking and choosing than the cumbersome way of having to consider what the preference is. So I don't know that it's not about choosing. It's not. It's more, as you've already described, about not regretting, for example, the choice we didn't take, or anticipating where this particular choice is going.
Yeah. Well, and I appreciate, Jean, you bringing that in, because of course there's always the other side. And this is one of the valid criticisms that I hear often of one way that we could think about this teaching in the Dharma is that, this means that we shouldn't pick and choose, or that we shouldn't have opinions, or that we shouldn't make distinctions. And of course that's not true, because part of our challenge is to work skillfully with the world as it is, and with that there are many situations where we do have to decide this or that. You know, like when we vote, you have to have an opinion. I'm going to vote for this one and not for that one. And it's really important that we make those distinctions about lots of things. You know, there is right and wrong. There is morality. There is harm and not harm. And so, as with the emptiness teachings, you know, when we're thinking about these things, we always have to consider that this is not a fundamentalist rule that one applies to everything and then becomes some kind of amoral, stupid person, right? I think what Seng Chan is really inviting us to do is just to really, really be aware of how much this tendency that we have to nitpick and judge everything is an obstruction to our awakening and does, as Galen Ferguson said, colonize our minds with judgment from external sources. So I really do appreciate you bringing in that point so that we can, you know, kind of balance, rebalance if it was sounding like, uh-oh, you know, I'm not supposed to have any opinions about anything. Because that's not what this is saying, in my view. I mean, maybe others of you have other ways that you think about that. Yeah. Yeah, Susan.
I was just thinking that it's like there's two different topics here, two different levels. And one is a discernment where we have to choose based on our ethics and values and what's for the best. And the other is about the inward look. And are we stuck in an inferior position or opinion of ourselves? Or a superior position, you know, looking at ourselves in a superior. And somewhere in between that is a balance where it's either inferiority or superiority. And getting away with judgments that maybe pains that we've lived through or opinions that have been put on us by others or in our family or our culture and that are not helpful, that don't help us flourish. So those are to be challenged through self-inquiry, and it's a lifelong process.
Absolutely.
Thank you. And I've really appreciated what you've spoken about tonight. It's really on the mark. Thank you.
Well, I just find that it's something that comes up in pretty much every single practice discussion that I'm ever in. This just seems to be the thing that most of us tend to struggle with is either some version of judgment that we use to separate ourselves from either from others or from appreciating our own effort, or this tendency to want to have something outside come and do it for us rather than our own agency. In like Shakti, you know, saying, no, ear, it's not your turn yet. You have to wait, you know. I mean, we can talk like that with our minds. We can say, no, actually, that's not true. That's not happening right now. I know you think it is, but it's not. You know, that's part of the discernment piece, I think, of how when we really study our minds, and we can start seeing these patterns that we have and being a little bit, you know, a little bit firm sometimes with ourselves if we notice that we're going in a particular direction that's separating and is creating an unwholesomeness or suffering.
Yes. And I think especially in our Western culture, we tend to err on the side of low self-esteem. Mm-hmm. And there's, I think, an expectation that we should be perfect and we're nothing until we get there. And that's just not going to happen. Thank you.
I have.
Thank you. So, yes, Peter, did you?
I was practicing another tradition back in the 70s and intensely. So, you know, I was a beginner at the time and I meditated every day for an hour every day. This went on for months and years. And one day I said, you know, I'm not getting anywhere. I give up. I'm just going to go and be me. Forget this. And about a year later, I found myself working underneath somebody's house and I was humming away. And I thought, the minute I let go of an expectation of what I wanted to be, something came over me that was quite wonderful by mistake. And I never forgot that experience of having to let go of that and get a perspective of over a year on myself, where I was 5 years before and where I was then. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing that. I think we're starting to kind of, I don't know usually how long we go, but maybe if there's anybody else, may just have a little pause here. Again, just looking at all of you, appreciating you. I'm going to find something because I'm sitting at my computer I can that I think would be a nice close. So let me just get it up here, just if you'll bear with me for 1 minute. I didn't expect to share this, but I think I will. So it's to conclude the interactions that I had with my root teacher, Catherine, about my own worries about my perceived imperfection, and that she called Kathy's question. And this is for you, Sally. I know you like this story, so I just thought since you're here, I like seeing you, I'll share it. And I'm going to read it. I wrote this little piece about it because it's just, I don't know, it's moving to me. I always told my Zen teacher how I felt like such an imperfect practitioner. How can it be that after so much time, I still had my same complaints? For the last 2 years of her life, we were estranged, and I didn't know it. But she was actually working on how to answer my question. I know this because Patrick told me about it after she died. Patrick said to me, "She kept working on your question." And I just want to pause for a moment. Here we were so mad at each other that we couldn't talk to each other. And she's working on my question. That is an example of the Dharma transcending small self, in my view. I am so moved by that. And I had no idea she was doing that because we were in our standoff. Anyhow, she kept working on your question, Patrick said, and she told me that she figured out a response. So after she had died, he told me what her response to my question was. And this is what she came up with. She said, "Practice is like this big tree that grows out of the center of the earth, and it is always there. You can touch it anytime. It doesn't matter what you think about how you're doing, about your complaints. That tree is just there. It's there to support you." And I still consider that one of her deepest teachings that I received in this way, you know, because of causes and conditions. So I just thought that would be something I'd like to leave you with. And interestingly, I shared that the other day with a group that I work with in Hollister, and there's a woman there who has physical difficulties too, and so she's often lying down and standing up and stuff. And when I shared that story, I looked up and she was actually had her arms around a tree. We were outside. It was so beautiful. So anyhow, there we go. There's just this big tree, no matter what you think about your practice, it's growing. It's always there, and it's there to support you. So may you find your trees, and thanks for coming. I'll lead the vows. Is that how we do it? Yeah. Okay. I'll lead the vows. Everybody else stay muted, but please join me and then we'll have a few announcements. "All beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.